ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, the Middle East war is sending economic shockwaves, along with other shocks, around the globe.
Fuel prices skyrocketing, supply chains in disarray, inflation surging.
And the question is a global recession inevitable?
And why doesn't the stock market seem to care?
On today's Global Roaming, we look at what's happening to the global economy in the shadow of war and what it will mean for all of us. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Latika Burke. Let's go roaming. Geraldine, it has been such a confusing situation trying to monitor what is going on with the Strait of Hormuz. One minute the strait was open, the next it's closed. It's becoming difficult, dare I say it, impossible, even though it's my job, to keep up with what the situation actually is.
Yes, I've sort of made a little decision. You know, you have to sort of audit yourself in terms of how much time you can give to reading and listening. I'm just not going to know all the little granular permutations of what's happening in the Strait. I'm not going to know. You know, I know we'll be bombarded with this and that and the other sort of extraordinary bit of audio between the Iranian Central Command or whatever they are. That's the trouble. We don't know who's in charge there now, and various ships. To me, I'm looking now beyond those details in a way.
I think it's really interesting to watch what's happening in Australia. So obviously I'm watching the politics very closely because Jim Chalmers is about to hand down a budget. And I think this is the mother of all budgets for Jim Chalmers. This is a huge test for him. And he is essentially now being held hostage to a global situation outside of Australia's making. And this is a really different set of circumstances, even compared to the pandemic and the war in Ukraine, I think, just because of how widespread this is, but also the policy responses it demands. So we saw last week the Australian government increasing defence spending. What are they going to do going forward? Because this, I think, is about to open up a real live debate across the world. Europe and the UK, for instance, there were similar calls to cut the fuel excise like Australia did when that happened. They haven't followed suit. The Americans haven't followed suit on that. In fact, if you look at the European way now, what seems to be coming out is actually we need our consumers to start feeling a bit of this pain. So they adjust their behaviour. They're starting very openly to now talk about if you can work from home, if you can use the public transport, do that more. I know there's been a bit of that in Australia too. It's true, but I also think there's another context to apply here, and that's decarbonisation. These jurisdictions that made a call to get to decarbonisation now can use this to accelerate that path and say, look, here is another reason why we've got to do it. And I think you'll see that.
Okay, well, look, it all makes it just a perfect time to introduce Justin Wolfers, bring him back to the program. He's a very prominent Australian-American economist, a very well-regarded commentator. He's also a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. Here he is now. Justin Wolfers, welcome back.
Mate, it's a pleasure.
How do you read the world economy right now? I mean, there's uncertainty everywhere. And if you look at the next few months, it does make for sobering reading. What particular measures do you keep your eyes on as a guide for what might come next?
So where are we? We were poised to enter 2026 and for the world to be something only economists could love, which is boring. And it turns out that the script writers over here in the US in the writers' room don't like boring. So they decided to punch it up. And obviously we're looking at the war right now. What the IMF has said so far, and I think they've got it right, is that means for the world as a whole, 2026 will be less good than it otherwise would have been, moderately weak even. So what indicators am I looking at? I'm looking at very, very closely at financial markets. And I don't want to sound like an economist who's like, well, stocks up, life good, stocks down, life bad. There's more to life than the stock market. But what I really care about at a moment like this, a time of immense uncertainty, and particularly where we care a lot about where we're going to be in 6 months' time, is I want an economic indicator that is forward-looking. So if I look at the latest unemployment report, it tells me how many people didn't have a job last month. It's not very helpful for a war and an oil shock and potentially a global shock that's still playing out. And so that's the reason I'm focused very much on financial markets.
And Justin, what are the financial markets making of it? They don't seem to have freaked out just yet. Why?
Well, it's because I think actually they care deeply. Let me put it this way. You're right to say that, you know, global stocks haven't plummeted. But actually, if you watch it day to day, you'll see a very different play. The play is every time the president escalates, the U.S. market tanks. And as bad as it is for the U.S., actually, it's even worse for our friends in Europe and Asia, which are much more energy dependent. And every time the president de-escalates, stocks go back up. And it turns out this is the old two-step, which is you escalate, de-escalate. And that's why the level over all is not at sort of terrible, horrible, no good, very bad places. But what it is telling you is, were the president to land on the escalation square, markets are saying they think it would be very, very bad for the world economy.
The trouble with watching this soaring stock market, as you're saying, from what I read, there's a lot of people on their phones jumping in, retail investors, really who are using it as a true speculative tool, plus the rallies that are occurring, which sort of seesaw up and down on a very narrow range of stocks. So watching from Australia, I wonder if, quite frankly, I'm watching a bunch of amateurs jumping in.
Geraldine, my first ever job was working on the Sydney racetrack. I used to be a bookies runner. And it sounds like you were just criticising financial markets for being a bunch of degenerate gamblers who can't help but just keep betting, betting, betting. And I tell you what, Randwick Racecourse definitely is that. And if you think Randwick's bad, you should go out to Warwick Farm. But it turns out, actually, that the wisdom of that crowd, each of whom you might think of as maybe someone you don't want to invite over for Christmas dinner, that crowd turns out to be remarkably good at picking the winners of horse races. Again, not perfect, but better than the alternative. And here, it's actually altogether different. I want you to maybe back off of thinking about these folks as betting on the stock market as chain-smoking degenerates and remember that an investment house like Goldman Sachs has dozens of PhDs poring over the data that they're getting people on the ground in Iran, that they're looking at satellite photos of what's still working and what's not. Because the thing is, if you can figure out where this war is going 10 minutes a day, a week, a year ahead of the rest, there's billions of dollars in that. And so these folks, again, a million ways you can criticize them, but there's a lot of people betting a lot of money based on very serious advice. And really the most important thing is this is a forward-looking indicator.
So Justin, the phrase I keep reading, and I may have even included it in some of my reports myself, is global recession. Are we heading for a global recession?
So the answer is less, it's more likely we avoid it than we go into one. A slightly better answer, I understand, Latika, why you'd use that framing, and I've been drawn into it as well. Who cares? Now, by that, I don't care if people lose their livelihoods. What I mean is, I want to move away from the binary thinking towards more continuous thinking. Are we doing worse as a result of this? Yes. War is really, really serious business. And the economic consequences of this war are absolutely first order. I don't want to deny the humanitarian, the ethical, the legal, the foreign affairs implications of it as either. But I speak a language, economics, which somehow resonates with people, maybe more than it should at moments like this. But in the US, I get asked day in, day out, what's going with fuel prices and am I going to have to pay more at the pump? That's only a small part of the economic story. If you force a generation to have to spend more on defense, that fundamentally changes government finances. It changes how much families have left over at the end of the week. The ways that wars filter through to economies are much broader than the very narrow questions, at the very least, I'm often getting asked in the US.
How will increased defence spending affect the global economy, in your view?
If we spend money on guns, we're not spending it on other stuff. Simple as that. And every member of your audience knows what it means to have a dollar less in their pocket. And it may be we'd spend that dollar on social cohesion. It may also be we spend it on beer and Skittles. Either way, you're doing without something you value and all you're getting is bombs in return. So let's take seriously that and try and figure out how big it is. So we just saw the president submitted his budget for next year. Now, this is a very arcane thing. The president's budget actually turns out not to mean anything. I know that sounds weird, unlike the prime minister, the treasurer's budget back home. But the president has asked to move the American military spend from $1 trillion a year to $1.5 trillion. The difference there is $500 billion. There's roughly 100 million American households. So therefore, the difference is about $5,000 per household. And that's next year. So that's the president's assessment of how much more expensive this increasingly dangerous world will be for Americans, right? And the thing about, you don't just spend extra next year and then just, you know, go back to normal the year after. First of all, whatever risks it is he's worried about, presumably stick around. And secondly, once you start doling out money like that, you create a, I believe the term is a military-industrial complex. And they hire a ton of lobbyists who come down and tell you that if you spend a dollar less on defense, everything will go terrible. So if it's $5,000 per household, and that sticks around for 10 years, now we're talking about $50,000 per household. So in Australian dollars, we're talking about $75,000-$80,000. That's the effect over here. Now, how big would the effect be for Aussies? Well, it depends on what Australia's defence response is.
So obviously energy has been the big immediate shock of this war and its immediate effects for countries like Australia. We've had service stations running out of fuel. We've had the Prime Minister jetting around to Asia and the Middle East, shoring up energy supplies. How do you see this global shortfall affecting global economic demand and also supply?
Here's the thing. Demand for oil is what economists call inelastic. What does that mean? It means you need it. If I'm going to drive to work tomorrow, I have to get there. So I can't go without. So what we have now is a whole bunch less oil. And how does a market, this is not done by governments and it's not done through jetting about, it's done by a market. How does a market help us make sense of that? And the answer is, if we've got 12% less oil, we've got to get people to buy 12% less oil. The way we do that is we let the price rise. And the thing is, even if the price were to double, I'd still buy enough petrol to get to work.
Mm.
And that's why what sounds like a relatively small disruption to the quantity of oil, 12% of global production, could actually cause the price to double. It's because you need prices to rise a lot before anyone starts to do without. And that's what happens here. So the answer is, if there's less oil, there'll have to be some doing without. How do we decide who does the doing without? Usually we let prices adjust. So therefore, who does without? It's the folks who get priced out when oil is twice as expensive. There are some ways to adjust that are pretty straightforward. So in the US already, people are reporting families are less likely to go on vacations three states over. So that's a form of adjustment people can do. Another is, I have an electric bike. I ride my bike to work. And in the short run, which is what we are right now, it's very hard to persuade people to use less petrol. But if we were to enter a world in which petrol would always be expensive, it becomes a lot easier. What do? Well, I'm going to buy an electric vehicle next. And the longer this goes on, the more people can make adjustments, and therefore the less painful the adjustment will be. So the pain that we have at the moment is the peak pain. And you've already seen, I think, electric vehicle sales, there's reports from Europe, electric vehicle sales are up pretty sharply over the past couple of weeks. And so it might lead people to make some of those adjustments. Some of those adjustments, by the way, my environmentalist friends would be very pleased with.
We're talking to the Australian-American economist and commentator Justin Wolfers about the state of the global economy. You might remember he made a very considerable contribution to the recent Boyer lectures, particularly about whether Australia's resilient enough to withstand any future shocks.
So we keep hearing from our leaders. So in Australia, the government is preparing to hand down the budget. And we've had both the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese repeatedly say, look, even if this war ended tomorrow, the tail, the economic tail, is still going to be long. how long? And are we still just talking about oil at that point, or are we talking about all those other supplies that we've been trying to get through from the Middle East, such as helium and some really important ingredients for things we don't even realize necessarily that we're using? What is it that defines that, Talwin, and how long do you think it really is?
So right now, markets are suggesting the tensions could remain high for weeks or months, not years. Now, by the way, we have a long history of underestimating the duration of wars, so don't take optimism too seriously. But if you look at oil price futures, they seem to suggest that oil is going to be high through 2027, 28, and 29. Not as high as it is right now, but higher than it was before the war, substantially higher. So, you know, the shock that persists will be maybe a third as large as it was. We're doing really rough arithmetic, but it'll be about a third of what we're suffering right now for a couple of years. Now, some of that might be because there's been some literal destruction of ports and drilling infrastructure and so on that literally takes time to rebuild. But I also suspect part of what's going on there is, well, actually, if they just get together and they hug it out, lots of things get back to normal. That would be good. But it's also possible they hug it out and in a year's time they're back at it. And all of a sudden, the Middle East feels more dangerous. And what markets are pricing is not this shock, but the possibility that the world has revealed itself to be more dangerous and there'll be future shocks. So that's the lookout for the future part of this. The defense spending that comes out of this, which, as we discussed, I think could be very, very large, it would be realistic to think of that as being high for a decade. The rewiring of global power and of global influence, if, for instance, the American security umbrella becomes unreliable for the Australians, that's incredibly expensive, right? Do you really want to go and set up a military for a country of our size, and do you want to try and do that quickly? We're not there yet, but we've also seen things like the president sort of half walk away from NATO, which does sit and train a lot of really important military spending. And then there are sort of harder things, which is sometimes revealing a vulnerability is just as bad as creating one. And this exercise has revealed the global economy is vulnerable to attacks on the Strait of Hormuz. And it is not the only choke point on the globe. And so now that Iran understands its strength, how will it use it? Now, my guess is one of my favorite things about being Australian is often the rest of the world forgets about us. And that would be marvelous. I mean, it hurts our feelings, but it would be marvelous, because if they're in the business of extracting concessions and they come after the Americans and they come after the Europeans and they simply forget that we exist, that would be great. It could be they come after the developed world in a way that really has an effect on Australia.
Justin, what is your assessment of the US economy and its ability to withstand these shocks?
Issue for who wins a war is a function of how much you can damage the other side, for which the United States is clearly overwhelmingly the world's greatest power, and how much damage you can withstand. And that, I think, is a very telling part that the administration refuses to talk about. But the extent of suffering in the United States is A, real, and B, substantially less than anywhere else on Earth almost. I mean, the Middle East countries that are all rich, they think this is great. But we are, roughly speaking, the United States is, roughly speaking, energy independent. And so it has hurt the US less than it's hurt Europe, less than it's hurt Asia. Well, so no one likes the president anymore. And if his ability to withstand political heat is very low, it doesn't matter how destructive his bombs are, because the Iranians can keep the strait closed and exact political pain upon him that he seems quite unwilling to wear. And so it's not a question of the state of the... But I think this is important, which is, what matters here is a function of the willingness to withstand economic pain that translates into political pressure. Because the president went to war without ever asking Americans for sacrifice, without ever explaining why this was important, the commitment of the folks in the suburbs is zero. They're just pissed that petrol's more expensive. And as a result, they're willing to vote out Republicans at the next election based on this. And as a result, the president has a very weak hand, because the economic pain translates into a degree of political pain that the president is unable and unwilling to withstand.
What are the policy options available to the US, and how would you compare those to the policy options available to the Australian government? Institutionally, are there any differences that make one stronger than the other or put one in a better hand than the other?
Yeah, the US started the war, the US can end it. Albo could sit around and decide war's a really bad idea, but no one cares. And I mean that with all due effect and reverence for our Prime Minister.
What about inflation, though? Isn't this something that policymakers will be preoccupied with if energy costs are driving up prices?
Absolutely preoccupied with, but things like a petrol tax holiday are gimmicks and band-aids.
Well, that's what we did in Australia.
I read the Australian papers enough. And even the populist Americans have avoided it. It doesn't change the
underlying policy. So you don't think the government should have done that to insulate from the shock? You actually think it's better to have people feel that pain?
No, I'm against pain. But if you gave me a bucket of money, $100 million, and you said, Justin, you get to give $100 million to alleviate human suffering, I wouldn't give it to drivers rather than non-drivers, and I wouldn't give it to people in proportion to how fuel inefficient their cars are. That's what a gas tax holiday is. It is a terribly, terribly targeted social policy that goes to rich more than poor, that goes to folks who drive big cars rather than small cars, that has differential impacts by urban versus rural. It is hard to imagine a social problem for which a petrol tax holiday is the efficient solution.
Can we zoom out a bit from that? You said in your Boyer lectures that Australians, the strength of Australia's institutions, I mean, we've been hearing this right from the financial crisis through on, that the strength of our institutions in Australia will insulate us from the global shocks. Is that still your view here in 2026?
Having strong institutions means we will deal better with these shocks than if we had weak institutions. Unquestionably, yes. So a very simple one is, the exchange rate helps us. Having a floating exchange rate helps us a whole heck of a lot. Even better, Australian policymakers, as much as you could and every day do, criticise, you know, what they do today versus tomorrow and when they do it and how they do it. And I just played that game. Australian policymakers are still more likely to make choices that are in the public interest than is the case in many, many other countries. So, Latika, I love your question. And I love it because what it forces one to do is zoom out. So often in Australian economic policy debates, the question is, will the RBA rise off or not tomorrow? What's going to happen to fuel prices next week? Fair enough, reasonable questions, but they're actually fundamentally boring. The really important question is, why is Australia one of the world's most prosperous nations? What led to that? How can we defend that? And how can we even lean into it so that, you know, everything that makes life in Australia grand is even grander.
Justin Wolfers, thank you so much for joining us again on Global Roaming.
A pleasure.
Geraldine, if he is right about some of the things he was saying there, it might be the second interview we've done together where we both leave feeling reassured, because he also wasn't entertaining any notion of a global recession, really, was he?
Just a mild one, which I might add that if you look underneath the IMF, they do say there could be a mild recession. But as he also makes it plain, and I thought he did that quite well, mild recessions, you know, two words, can have huge impacts on daily lives for real people. So, you know, don't let's be cool about mild recessions, but I don't know quite when, though.
No, I think only Mr. Trump and the Iranians might know when, Geraldine, because as he rightly says, the greatest policy option of all, to paraphrase Whitney Houston, is stopping the war. And really, there's only two parties now who have a stake and interest in doing that. And no progress there so far, Geraldine.
No, and I mean, and just that bit about institutions. I mean, one of the things that I think is going to be very interesting to look at in Australia is just how the Reserve Bank manages all of this. You know, that they are determined that the inflation jockey, shall we say, won't be let out of the cage the way it was in the 70s and early 80s when in the last gigantic sort of oil price rise shock we had. And there's been very sort of sobering reminders of people giving interviews sort of saying, look, this is the moment we must not yield, even though we'll have to explain ourselves and Australians will say, two more interest rate rises? You've got to be kidding. But they say, you know, people with short memories don't realise what damage it did to expectations, employer-labour relations in the 70s when people just believed that prices were going to keep going on up. So that's another very interesting aspect, I think, of what we're going to watch in the aftermath.
I agree. And I'm watching with interest the Australian budget. What is it? A couple of weeks now. If I was in government right now, Geraldine, and I watched the UK with some dismay and agog, I would not let this crisis go to waste. This is the time, if you're a government that's been toying with some difficult policy decisions or some difficult arguments to sell that they might never have been able to do but secretly wanted to do.
Now, Latika, we've had some interesting feedback, this is from Gail. I've never heard anybody quite so certain of his own opinion as James Crabtree, who was our guest last week, Latika, on the state of the UK, nor did he come up for air. But I would have liked Latika to challenge him within the interview on his optimism. And who are the big spenders she referred to who've left London, making it less vibrant? How does that work? In what way has it affected the city? The crime situation is self-evident. Crabtree may be correct, but maybe put your concerns to him directly next time. Thank you, Gail. Now, Latika.
Gail wants a fight club, Geraldine.
He was optimistic.
I think it was good to take stock of what James had to say because maybe he's right. You know, he did speak about a lot of institutional strengths, and when he put it the way he did about he'd rather be in Europe and having the club of all these countries around him than
he'd rather
Australia.
Have their universities than our universities. I heard him say
you
that.
You know, I that was a little snobbish, true. I don't disagree with him about the European club, though. I do think Australia could be quite vulnerable very suddenly. Things like that, I didn't totally disagree with him. But I think what I was trying to say in my commentary at the end, Gail, was that a lot of these things are a vibe about where London's at the moment. And I think James was talking very much about some of the fundamental institutional strengths.
Don't forget to write to us. You can see that we do respond. We let you influence us. We love your questions and feedback. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to our producer on this episode, Aston Brown, and acting executive producer, Kylie Gray.
Kylie Morris and I'll be back tomorrow. We're talking to American attorney, writer and former executive director of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, about accountability in war and how the International Court of Justice case against Israel and the International Criminal Court case against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is progressing. See you, Geraldine.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.